From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. John Wells is out today. And of course, radio is not exempt from all of the illnesses sort of rampantly circulating around this community and our country. So not only am I without my co-host, we also just heard our first guest, Josh Fishman, senior editor at Scientific American Magazine, doesn't have a voice. Difficult to do an interview without a voice. So we will reschedule him. He'll be previewing the top 10 emerging technologies for 2022, and always a great conversation with Josh Fishman. Instead, we'll rebroadcast an interview with journalist Stephen Kersey. He's written a book called The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. Deep in the Appalachian Mountains lies the last truly quiet town in America. It's Green Bank, West Virginia. It's a place at once futuristic and old-fashioned, home to the Green Bank Observatory, where astronomers search the depths of the universe using the latest technology, but school children go without Wi-Fi or iPads. There's a ban on all devices emanating radio frequencies that might interfere with the observatory's telescopes. So we will rebroadcast that very interesting interview. And then, do you suspect you've had asymptomatic COVID, or are you simply wondering if you have antibodies or immunity against COVID? Dr. Joshua Gunn, the chief scientific officer at Ethos Research and Development, will join me. Ethos has developed a home test that measures your COVID immunity with just a simple pinprick of your finger and a test you can do at home before sending off for a result back in 48 hours. I did that test myself a couple of days ago, and Joshua and I will speak about that. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Now, what if there were a place where you could digitally disconnect for good? I think a lot of us would enjoy that right about now. No social media, where people weren't constantly scrolling on their cell phones, where forest hikes weren't ruined by a ringtone, or where getting lost meant really getting lost because a gadget or GPS wasn't going to rescue you. Our next guest, Stephen Kersey, has written a book about one such place. It's a small town in an isolated corner of Appalachia, Green Bank, West Virginia, where electronic noise is tightly monitored and restricted. Why? Well, Stephen Kersey joins us to tell us after writing a book on the subject of this curious little town. It's called The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. Stephen Kersey, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Lynn and John, it's great to be here. Thanks for bringing me on.
A lot of us, upon reading the title and the tagline of your book, would think that it's an ideal that we will be striving more and more to attain. But tell us really what's behind this quiet zone.
So back in the 1950s, 60 years ago, the National Science Foundation decided that America needed a really big investment in radio astronomy. This was a fairly new branch of astronomy, only founded in the 1930s, sort of by accident, when some engineers essentially started realizing that their radio antennas, were picking up extraterrestrial static, you know, from the cosmos, radio waves coming in from the far reaches of space. And this developed into a science called radio astronomy. And it was deemed that Green Bank, West Virginia, would be the best place in the eastern United States to host a major national facility with a handful of radio telescopes. It needed to be in Green Bank in West Virginia, in the remote mountains of West Virginia, because this was deemed to be like the quietest place, perhaps, on the eastern, in the eastern United States for these telescopes to be. Radio astronomy needs to be done in a radio quiet place, because you don't want to have a whole lot of radio static interfering with what those telescopes are picking up, in the same way that you don't want to have, you know, optical telescopes in the middle of a bright city where you have lots of light pollution all around you.
Tell us just how remote and how sparsely populated this place is. I think we in the West think of, you know, the West would have been a good place to put it because, You know, it's very sparsely populated out here, but tell us about this area of Appalachia. And by the way, is it Appalachia or Appalachia?
I think it depends where you are in Appalachia or Appalachia, and you ask that question. But people in the Green Bank area call it Appalachia, and that's why I refer to it as well. So there are probably plenty of places in the western United States that could have been the host for this radio astronomy facility as well, but they wanted it to be close to Washington, D.C., where the National Science Foundation is based and where a number of universities were located as well that already had a number of scientists involved in this field of radio astronomy to make it easier for them to visit those telescopes and get back and forth. Green Bank is in the middle of Pocahontas County. This is a Rhode Island-sized county. It's massive, and it has no highways going through it. It's about two-thirds federal or state forest. Today, it only has about 8,000 people. There's only one high school, I think three elementary middle schools. There's one newspaper. There's not a whole lot there. It's minimal industry. Back in the early 20th century, there was a real burgeoning or real booming logging industry, which kind of went bust when all the trees were cut down. So all that industry kind of, you know, faded by the time that the astronomers came into town in the 1950s. It was mostly just pastoral land and a couple loggers remaining and just, you know, people going to school and having small jobs in other ways. So it's very much naturally quiet. It's also in the Appalachian Mountains. It's in this 4 mile long kind of valley surrounded, I think it's at about 2,000, 3,000 foot elevation, but it's surrounded by mountains that go up to about 5,000 feet. So it's this perfect spot. It's like a natural bowl. And those mountains both keep out the outside world's radio waves, but they also keep out the outside world's kind of ideas and influence in a lot of ways. It's not an easy county to get into. If you're there, you're probably born there, or you really want to be there, but you don't get there accidentally for the most part.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are having a conversation with Stephen Kersey. He has written The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. And there are a number of characters and strange organizations, and they don't text each other, so they've got post-it notes that they hand each other in the post office or in the general store. But also, William Pierce, who is the person that put together the National Alliance, which is a neo-Nazi organization, is in that county. Are they actually in that town, or are they just in the surrounding county somewhere?
Yeah, they're about 30 miles south of Green Bank in that county of Pocahontas. In a lot of ways, this is like a town-sized county because there's so few people. There's only one high school, and they're all connected, really, by the newspaper, by the education system, by everybody kind of going to the same general stores and rubbing elbows with each other. And so William Pierce, who was not just any neo-Nazi leader, he was leader of America's once preeminent, best organized, most influential neo-Nazi organization through the 90s and early 2000s. Also, he was the author of an infamous novel called The Turner Diaries, which the FBI has considered and called the Bible of the racist right. It's been behind dozens of acts of deadly far-right terrorist violence worldwide, most notably the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. The perpetrator, Timothy McVeigh, was actually found with that book in his car with passages underlined. And he was known to really pass around that book and consider it like a real motivating text for himself, along with other far-right figures who have cited that text. And he's based there in the Quiet Zone, just south of Green Bank, for many of the same reasons that drew in the radio astronomers. He wanted to get away from it all. William Pierce wanted to get away from minorities and law enforcement and civil rights groups. He wanted to be able to retreat to a remote mountain holler where he could buy a lot of land for really cheap and get away from it all and pursue his own kind of fringe ideas. And in a lot of ways, that's also what drew the radio astronomers out there to this quiet place. They could pursue their own kind of, like, you know, quirky branch of science, radio astronomy, without being bothered by the outside world's noise.
Stephen, you and I were speaking in the virtual green room before the interview started, and we were both telling each other how we had not heard of this place. And you've now heard of it much longer than I have, but I just heard of it just a couple of days ago when Lynn and I were talking about the book. So I would assume there's a lot of other people that haven't heard about it. At the same time, I've met so many folks who feel that they're sensitive to some of the new technology, specifically 5G that's coming out. They feel, you know, that that's a problem for them. So I suspect, one, your book's going to get a lot of buzz, and two, there might be a land grab going on in that county if there are opportunities, because there are a lot of people that would like to be in that sort of environment. What are your thoughts on that?
John, you're absolutely right. There is actually a land grab happening there by people who are trying to get a piece of that quiet. I've been in contact in the book and since the book came out with probably the major realtor in that county. His name is Oak Hall, and it's just been soaring real estate values, especially from out-of-staters trying to come in there because they want a piece of quiet. Partly because of the pandemic, they want to get away from cities and have a big piece of land for a cheap value where they're kind of away from a lot of other people's influence. But then there is quite a few of people known as electrosensitives. These are people who actually feel physically allergic to Wi-Fi and cell service and other forms of modern electromagnetic radiation that are coming from electronic gadgetry all around us, be it your microwave or your stove or your refrigerator. And hundreds of these people have come into the Green Bank area because they believe it's like their last refuge in a noisy world where they can be free of the pain. So much so that land values are booming in that area because of the electrosensitives who are coming in. That realtor, Oak Hall, told me that 10% of all his land sales, about 200 homes over the past decade, have been to electrosensitives or people with concerns about electromagnetic sensitivity and trying to get away from that.
Stephen, there's a bit of a push-pull right now in this area, in the quiet zone, those who want to really maintain the electrosensitives, right? And others who want to maintain the quiet zone. And then there are others who are striving to move into where technology is accessible. And surprisingly, and what the media has reported on in the past is not really accurate, that there, what you report on now is that there is Wi-Fi and people do have cell phones, whether or not they get a signal or whether they're constantly walking around searching for a signal is another part of this story. Can you talk about that?
Before I went to Green Bank, I had expected to find a place that was basically offline. Headlines about this place range from the land where the internet ends to the town where smartphones are banned to the place where Wi-Fi is illegal to even the observatory itself having t-shirts that say, "Welcome to the quietest town in America." You know, you're surrounded by 13,000 square miles of quiet. So I went in there expecting to find a place where not only people would not have smartphones and Wi-Fi, but where they would kind of share my own philosophical aversion to these devices. I myself haven't had a cell phone since 2009. It's like a personal choice that's kind of evolved into an obstinate refusal. And I thought going out here, I'd, you know, find my people. And it didn't take very long before, yeah, everybody seemed to have a smartphone. I remember going into a classroom at the elementary school and third graders and asking who here has smartphones. Every single hand went up. The first time I actually went into the middle school, an eighth grader was in trouble for setting up a hotspot, a Wi-Fi hotspot. He kind of hacked into the computer's, into the teacher's, his teacher's system. And that's really a problem because the school abuts the astronomy observatory itself. Like those soccer fields behind the school, they just basically look up at the massive Green Bank telescope. It's like 500 feet tall. It's right there. And so to have a hotspot at the school, it's very much impacting the astronomy work being done there. But it's not just the school that occasionally has a hotspot. I did a drive around with the quote unquote quiet zone cop, this guy who drives around this truck and it's got like 17 antennas coming out of the top. And they act as a direction of finding array to allow him to track down sources of renegade radio frequency interference. And before we even got into the parking lot, I think we picked up 6 Wi-Fi signals like right across the street. Within a 2-mile radius, we picked up more than 100 Wi-Fi signals. And since the pandemic, we were talking about that boom of people coming in. You know, a lot of these people coming in, they want to have Wi-Fi. if they're not electrosensitive. But it's also more people working from home these days. And so they want to have more technology, and they want to have Wi-Fi as well for their work. And so it's now nearing 200 Wi-Fi signals just within a several mile radius of the observatory. That's a problem for the science. And it's also a problem for the electrosensitives who are coming here just trying to like grab onto one of the last quiet pieces of America.
Wow, that's fascinating. It would seem that if you're moving into this very isolated spot, you're sort of moving in there with this agreement that you won't engage technology in this way, especially because this Green Bank Observatory, the success of what it can, you know, what it's doing depends on not having radio frequency or Wi-Fi sort of interference, right?
Yeah, there's a lot bundled in that, you know. So people moving in, yeah, you would think that they know what they're getting into, especially electrosensitives, since they're actually fleeing the radio noise. But if you're born there, or if you're a kid raised there, like, did you choose not to have Wi-Fi, or did you choose to live in a place where there's these restrictions on it? No. And so for them, it's like, well, I want to have it. And why should I have to sacrifice what I see everybody outside the quiet zone being able to have? And there's a real sense being there of that tension. I remember being at the local general store one time and speaking with a father and son, Matthias and his dad, Daniel. I had already spoke with Matthias before, and he very much told me, like, don't have a cell phone, never had cell service, never missed it, and we don't have Wi-Fi at home, he told me. And then a couple months later, I saw him and his dad at that general store again. I was like, hey, do you guys still not have Wi-Fi? Because I've been growing skeptical after doing those drive-arounds with the Quiet Zone cop. And they're like, nope, no Wi-Fi. And I look at them like, really? Because I think everybody else has it. And they kind of looked at me, and they looked at each other and kind of like sheepishly grinned. And then the dad, who's actually a minister, says, actually, we do have Wi-Fi. So here's like a man of God lying to me, breaking one of the Ten Commandments, you know, about whether or not he has Wi-Fi. What other town in the world, right? Or do people feel ashamed that they need to hide whether or not they have Wi-Fi in the house? So I asked the dad, why'd you lie to me? Why didn't you want to be open about it? And he says, well, the observatory provides a lot of jobs in the community that are big economic importance to this area, and that doesn't have a whole lot in it. It's more than 100 jobs. It's millions of dollars of economic input. But then the dad added, but when the fast lane is going 75 miles per hour, that's the lane you have to be in. So for him, it was a sense of he had to have Wi-Fi for the sake of his kids, for them to have educational benefits, perceived educational benefits from Wi-Fi, and just to be able to give them the access to the online world that the outside world has.
Our planet is very noisy. It's also very loud. I think the noisiest place on the planet might be in northern New Jersey. You've got the 10 million people from Manhattan, and you've got all these people from New Jersey. It's just really noisy with all of the microwave and all the radio waves, everything else there. And yet a couple of guys bought this old telescope, radio telescope from Bell Labs, and they set it up in the middle of this noisy place, and they discovered the echoes of the Big Bang, the microwave background that occurred 13.7 billion years ago. Somehow they were able to hear this little thing and then separate all this other data so that they could have this extraordinary discovery. And Lynn and I had a conversation with someone that was looking at neutrinos from a far off star and talking about how noisy the world was. And they've been able to put together, through a bunch of sophisticated algorithms, ways to be able to separate the noise of these neutrinos. Is current technology allowing us to do a better job of that? And does the federal government, that is also doing some spying on their adversaries, are they able to separate some of this noise out of the way so they can get their job done?
That's a question I put to the astronomers and the engineers at the Green Bank Observatory itself. And the response is, yeah, there is technology out there that would allow it, but it's really time consuming and it's really expensive. The Green Bank telescope, which is like the flagship telescope there in Green Bank, it's It's monitoring the skies 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's basically always taking in a massive amount of data. And in order to run that data through like the algorithms and through some kind of filtration system that would separate all the noise, it would be incredibly expensive, and it would also slow down the entire process. And the expense is really a big thing, because already the Green Bank Observatory is fighting for its financial survival. So about a decade ago, the National Science Foundation actually determined that the Green Bank Observatory might not be worth its funding any longer. And it put it up for financial review with the potential to being mothballed potentially. This is our nation's very oldest national radio astronomy observatory. The Green Bank Telescope is the world's largest fully tellable radio telescope. There's no other as big that can move with 120, 180 degrees and look in all directions of the sky. No other telescope in the world has that capability. So, but nevertheless, the National Science Foundation was saying, we don't think it's worth its, you know, $10 or $15 million upkeep any longer. And so there's a real struggle for survival on the part of the Green Bank Observatory, where only a couple of years ago, they were finally able to get funding secured from the National Science Foundation for another 5 years. So they, you know, they have a lot of other concerns. Like they need to have enough money to pay their staff, to pay their engineers, to pay their astronomers. They don't have the extra budget to invest in a major technology that would allow them to keep out all the noise, that would allow them to filter out all the noise. So very much they're dependent on cooperation from the community to keep that area quiet. And also, I put that question to the principal scientist at the observatory, Jay Lockman, early on in my reporting. He's like, yeah, the technology is there, but think about the analogy to drinking water. You know, you don't start with something really dirty, like sewage, and then try and turn it into Evian or Poland Springs. That doesn't sound very appealing, for one. And also, it's just really, really hard and expensive. Like, imagine all the work you'd have to do to get to that. You start with something that's really clean, and then you take out a little bit of something.
Well, that's a really good point, because probably one of the most extraordinary things that's happened in the observing of our universe is the Hubble Space Telescope, which just turned 30 last year. And that's only a couple hundred miles above the Earth in orbit, and has to turn itself away from the infrared that's coming off the planet. And the JW, James Webb Telescope, is slated to launch in early December. Finally, it's a couple years late, but that is going to sit a million miles from Earth, and it's going to be away from the moon, away from the sun, and it's going to have all the sophisticated shielding so it can do the radio astronomy, the infrared, I think specifically in the infrared spectrums. And maybe they can get some time on that. I mean, I don't know. That's going to be, I mean, everybody wants a piece of the James Webb. Everybody wants to point the James Webb in some direction and do something specific. So I think that that's probably what's going to be happening in the future, because as you said, it is expensive to take all that chafe and move that out of the way when you're collecting so much data.
I mean, it's a reality that the observatory knows that, you know, it can only, its window into the radio universe from Green Bank is getting smaller and smaller because of the surrounding radio noise. And there may come a day where we just can't do radio astronomy anymore on Earth, where we'll have to set up some kind of telescope on the far side of the moon, right? Which has a constant look into the universe without any interference from the United States. But just think about the expense. Like, this telescope in Green Bank, it's a 2.3 acre dish. It's the size you could fit two football fields. That's the acreage of two football fields. Like, how are you going to get all those materials up on the moon? You know, how are you going to get them, like launch them out into space and then build some kind of giant canopy or whatever out there that's going to collect those radio signals? Like, you want to have a really big dish to get like a real range of radio signals. And that's really hard to do when you're, you know, trying to build a telescope in space. So for now, it's still the case that it's our best option to try and just keep out the radio noise in these radio telescope facilities that are on Earth.
Stephen, before we let you go, and we have just a few minutes left, I wanted to bring it back to the people of Green Bank. And, you know, here in the Park City School District, we boast that we have 1-to-1 computer or laptop to student ratio that starts in, I think, the second or third grade. And some of the, you know, there has been some talk in this community about, is this a good thing? Is this taking away, you know, a more authentic, more organic way of learning and of being? And, you know, the as you say, the elementary slash middle school in Green Bank is the only school, you know, in the nation without, you know, Wi-Fi, iPads, computer access, all of that. How do you see, and how do they use this as a tool to enrich learning, or do they? And what do you think about that?
So they do have computer access. It just has to be wired. And because it can't be Wi-Fi or wireless computer lane, it makes it more difficult to get all the students at the Green Bank Elementary School on those computers. You know, you can't have a mobile computer lab that rolls into the classroom and they're all connected automatically. You've got to filter all the students through that one hardwired computer lab. And that can make it difficult for testing, you know, for getting all the kids to have computer access and typing practice and all those things. There's a real debate going on, you know, around the world about the benefits or, you know, lack thereof of bringing more technology into schools. And there's quite a few schools that have, you know, done things like ban Wi-Fi and said no smartphones in school and said, you know, maybe we need to rethink this one laptop per child policy. And Baltimore schools actually implemented a similar policy, and they found that kids' test scores went down after having it. You know, who knows what this is? Is this because the technology is bad, or because we're just not quite good at implementing it and, you know, utilizing it to increase test scores and bring those benefits to students? But either way, it's not a panacea. It's not like a golden bullet, or a silver bullet, right? That we bring technology in and things automatically improve. In Green Bank as well, there's a real tradition of oral learning. That's like an Appalachia kind of thing where you tell stories and you talk these things out. And I talked with the math coach for the county, Joanna Burke Kinderman, and she had implemented policies in the schools that kind of got kids more into, you know, squares of learning where their desks sat together and they talked to each other more and they had interactions and they could kind of, like, you know, ask questions. And it's very much not technology based. And so for that area, there was a sense of, like, the technology isn't necessarily good for us. It's not necessarily, like, going to improve things. And we need to work with what we know, which is the storytelling tradition, to try and improve, you know, what's happening here in the schools, be it for math or other grades. And there's also the reality in Green Bank that the observatory is an incredible educational partner. Like, aside from that debate over whether or not tech is good or not to have in schools, like, it's undoubtedly the fact, and every educator I think in the county would agree with this, that having an observatory in your backyard with world-renowned astronomers, PhDs, engineers, having that influence on your school system is invaluable. The elementary middle school's robotics club is coached by a PhD astrophysicist and her engineering husband. They won the statewide robotics competition. A school without Wi-Fi that can't have iPads won the statewide robotics competition. The high school is coached by the software, another software engineer from the observatory. They came in second place in the statewide robotics competition. Like, in a lot of ways, that scientific influence is just invaluable to the community, and they would, the educators at least, would not give that up for the sake of bringing in a little bit more cell service and Wi-Fi.
It is just such a fascinating story. I could keep talking to you for another hour, but we've got to let you go. Stephen Kersey is our guest. He's a journalist. He attended what I know to be the best journalism school in the country, Columbia University. His work has appeared in New York Times, New Yorker, many other outlets, and he does not have a cell phone. That's a whole other part of this story that we didn't get to, but it's an interesting one. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me on. It was great to talk to you both. Thanks for the thoughtful questions.
My next guest is Dr. Joshua Gunn. He's the Chief Scientific Officer at Ethos Research and Development. It's based in Kentucky. Now, with so many questions surrounding immunity to COVID, things like, how long does the booster last if someone gets COVID? How long does that immunity last post-COVID? What if I haven't received the booster? Can I have natural immunity? Ethos Laboratories is making an effort to eliminate all of this uncertainty with a new test. It's called True Immune Test, which can determine a person's COVID immunity with just a drop of blood from their finger. The test costs $125. It provides accurate results within 24 to 48 hours, allowing people to make informed decisions about their risk level and even help them determine when and if a booster shot is necessary. Dr. Joshua Gunn, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me, Liam. I appreciate the opportunity, and I hope you're doing well out there.
Well, we are doing well. It must be a little different here than it is in Australia at the moment, looking outside at a powder day.
Yeah, it certainly is. We're slowly getting back to, some normal life habits, but cases are on the rise here again. So only time will tell. But obviously, everybody's dealing with the same landscape at the moment.
Yeah, just a question out of curiosity. You know, during the whole course of COVID, both Australia and New Zealand seem to have been absolutely 100% closed down. You can't come and go. Yet I've heard of people going to Australia recently or having plans to go. So has it opened back up?
So there certainly has been some international travel open back up since December 1st. And even as early as November last year, it obviously does come with certain restrictions. Hotel quarantines were certainly in place early on. Right now, it is relatively normal from an entry standpoint, although flight numbers are quite limited. So certainly the airline schedule is not back to normal, but there are international arrivals at least a few times a week. So that's certainly contributed to some of the cases. And I think as 2022 progresses, we'll see, more normal international travel, making it a little easier to get back and forth.
Right. Well, your accent gives you away that you sound like a native Australian, but Ethos Research and Development is based in Kentucky. Does that mean you typically live in Kentucky, or are you one of those people trying to come and go?
Yeah, it's a great question. So our headquarters is in Newport, Kentucky, so right across the river from downtown Cincinnati. And that has been my base since 2013. With COVID, I've certainly been in Australia a lot more the last couple of years than was planned, and was stuck here with border closures. But I am normally based at the lab right there in Newport. So, yeah, that's home base.
Great. Well, let's get to this true immune test. It's kind of exciting. I think that, it was about a year ago when people were trying to go get antibody tests to find out if they had immunity, to find out in some cases if they had asymptomatic COVID. And it was my sort of feeling at the time that there wasn't a lot of accuracy there. So there was, there was, at least in the media, and from the CDC talking about maybe you don't want to go run out and get those tests. And so Ethos has developed this home test. Tell me what's different about this test than those tests, the antibody tests of a year or 18 months ago.
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you will remember that there was a flood of antibody tests hit the market in the early stages of the pandemic. And a lot of that, I think, arose from the fact that what made this virus, or at least the publicity around the virus, quite unique was that there was this phenomena of asymptomatic infection. And so a lot of folks were curious, was that cough or sore throat or cold symptoms I had a few weeks ago, was it COVID? So a lot of those antibody tests that folks ran out to get early on were rapid type tests, so instant tests or point of care tests that would give you an indication of a positive or negative result with a color change, similar to pregnancy tests and things that we're used to on the shelf, if you will. So there were a couple of issues there. One is obviously the accuracy. Any point of care or rapid test is going to be inferior to a more complex laboratory-based test. Not to say that they're not useful, but I think the CDC and other regulatory bodies were concerned that people may have been basing, important decisions on an instant test, which is typically not the clinical recommendation. So that was one issue. The second issue, which is more rooted in the science of infection, is the fact that those types of tests are going to measure what is called the presence of a binding antibody. So, you know, when we're exposed to a pathogen, you know, our immune system is going to generate a lot of different antibodies. And most of those, if not all of those, will be able to recognize and bind to the virus. But only a very small subset of those antibodies are going to be able to actually neutralize the virus. Okay, so you can almost think of it as, you know, you may have an army of 500 soldiers, but if only 10 of those soldiers is armed with weapons, you know, that's going to be a very different appearance to assuming that all of those soldiers were armed. And so folks were maybe getting a false sense of security by seeing a positive antibody result in the early stages of the pandemic because of the fact that they were only measuring these binding antibodies. So ethos, you know, we were fairly confident early on that the presence of neutralizing antibodies was going to be one of our avenues out of this pandemic. And so we focused on following the science very closely to identify technologies that were going to allow us to accurately identify and quantify that important subset of antibodies, neutralizing antibodies that are able to actually block and inhibit the virus from entering your cells. And so that is what TrueImmune represents. It is the first available laboratory-based test. As you mentioned, there is a home collection kit, but it is a laboratory-based test that will measure not only the presence of these neutralizing antibodies, but also report semi-quantitatively on how effective they are at blocking or inhibiting SARS-CoV-2 from entering your healthy cells.
Okay, so for me, a test magically showed up at the radio station, and I, along with one of my colleagues here, read over the instructions, and she actually helped me with the whole bit, the finger pricking and everything. But a couple drops of blood on the test, I put the whole thing in the sealed envelope and dropped it off at UPS. And it was a little longer than 48 hours later that I got my results. And I'm looking at them now. And yes, it says right here, specific neutralizing antibodies. And I can talk about this on air because good for me, I guess my booster's still working, or possibly I had asymptomatic COVID. I guess these things we'll never really know. Is that right?
Yeah, it's another great question. So no, we really won't. I mean, you know, the presence of neutralizing antibodies tells us that you have not only created an efficient immune response, but also a functional immune response that has generated these antibodies that can inhibit the virus. But where they came from is very difficult to pinpoint, because the production of these is the goal of every vaccine that's out there, every booster that's out there, and it also is the result of natural infection. So it's difficult to delineate the origin of those neutralizing antibodies. You know, the important element is that they are present and they're highly effective at doing what they should do.
Mm-hmm. A question I have is whether or not, so here's a for example. About a week ago, I was exposed to COVID. I had my booster, I don't know, a couple months ago, maybe now. So even though I was exposed, I felt, you know, a little secure in that I wouldn't get it. I had a rapid test. It was negative. I'm still waiting on my PCR test. But in the midst of all this, I took your test showing that I have, you know, I have a good amount of antibodies. So if there were the case, because a lot of people now are probably walking around not knowing that they have COVID, and they do, especially with Omicron, you know, could you possibly take this test not knowing you have COVID? It shows up that you have high antibodies. You see what I'm getting at there?
So is your question, could it be that those antibodies are a result of an actual recent infection as opposed to your assumption of a booster efficacy?
Exactly. Or a current infection. Yeah. I mean, if someone's taking the test and doesn't know that they currently have COVID, will the presence of antibodies show up?
Yeah, it's a good question. So it is unlikely, given the time lag that's required for neutralizing antibodies to be generated and detectable at those types of levels, you know, as opposed to the RNA material, the genetic material, which is detectable, you know, within the first couple of days of infection. Antibodies typically take, you know, 1 to 3 weeks to really peak in their development. So if you're walking around with an active infection, it is, and assuming that you haven't had any vaccines, boosters, or prior infection, it would be unlikely that a positive here would actually be a result of an active infection, more likely one of the vaccinations or boosters that you've received.
If you're just joining me on Cool Science Radio, I'm speaking with Dr. Joshua Gunn. He is the Chief Scientific Officer at Ethos Research and Development. It's based in Newport, Kentucky, right across the river from Cincinnati. I didn't know that. I'm curious about what Ethos does. You're Ethos Research and Development, but you're also Ethos Laboratories. What types of tests you also have, I think, just a regular COVID test, is that right?
Yeah, so Ethos Research and Development obviously is the R&D arm of the Ethos companies. And actually, you know, prior to COVID, our focus for the last 10 years has been on the development of novel diagnostics to further our understanding of chronic pain in actuality. So infectious disease is certainly a service that we offer, but our roots in the diagnostic development world are actually centered around chronic pain disorders and trying to identify novel biomarkers of chronic pain and other chronic diseases. So because we're incredibly fortunate to have talented scientists and a wonderful scientific staff, we were able to innovate on the COVID front as well. And yes, we were awarded an EUA for our active COVID infection test. So that's similar to what you referenced when you talk about PCR, you know, the test that folks are going to get to determine whether they have an active infection. And so that is obviously still a test that is utilized very widely. The TrueImmune came about initially in the early stages of the pandemic because we wanted to assist people in determining whether they had been exposed to the virus. But obviously now in the world we live sort of in the post-vaccination world, TrueImmune is becoming more and more popular for folks and organizations that wish to evaluate vaccine efficacy, but more importantly, monitor vaccine efficacy over time. You know, what's the longitudinal profile of these neutralizing antibodies, and can we use them to make informed decisions about when we should be looking at boosters or you know, better understanding what our vaccine schedule should look like. And the last point I'll make on the applications here is right now the focus of a lot of worldwide research is to actually pinpoint what we call a correlate of protection. So what would be the actual level of neutralizing antibodies that someone would need as a minimum to be protected from reinfection or breakthrough infection? And so, you know, your TrueImmune results, obviously as good as you can get, right? That's fantastic. But if someone was to receive a result that was 50% as effective as your result, would that be enough to protect them from infection? Or do we need folks to be in that highest quadrant? And this is the research that's being conducted right now by the inventors of a lot of this technology. And the hope is that we'll have a titer that we can look to say to someone, you need to be above this threshold in order to walk around and be confident that you won't be reinfected. And if you're below it, that's when we look for things like boosters. And if we're above it, you know, we retest at a later stage. So we do have a wide array of clinical services at Ethos, and we do have a national footprint. But like a lot of companies, our focus has been to try and help us dig our way out of this pandemic for the last you know, year and a half, 2 years.
Well, so much is changing. I mean, every day, every week, things are changing. We're learning new things that we didn't know before. I think that's why there's, you know, probably so much distrust around everything. And I think that, you know, even if you're fully vaccinated, you've had a booster, you know, as you say, you're walking around thinking that you're probably pretty well protected, but I don't think anyone believes that anymore. I mean, in this town, you know, we are a winter tourist, we're a ski town. We have, you know, we swell to like 5 times the size of our year-round population, and I don't think anyone feels safe. I'm walking around with my N95. And, you know, on the other hand, when I went to get a rapid test the other night, there was a 3.5 hour wait at this wonderful clinic who does. And when I went in, the doctor said, you know, there are so many positive cases, so many, everyone's got it. Everyone's walking around with it. But now if I get my TrueImmune test and I'm looking at my result and it shows that I have more than 80% neutralizing antibody immunity, I guess you would say it that way. You know, again, should I feel safe, or is it still such a question?
Yeah, it's a great point. So just to elaborate a little bit on what your test result actually means for anyone listening that obviously, you know, hasn't seen the report. So your result of greater than 80% inhibition means that this test is structured in a way that we actually test your blood sample's ability to block the virus from interacting with its target cell. So we put the target cell on a plate, we introduce the virus or the component of the virus that binds with that host cell, and then we introduce your blood sample to determine whether your blood sample is effective at blocking that protein-to-protein interaction. And your result indicates that you were able to block more than 80% of that binding possibility. So it was very effective at blocking that virus attaching to the cell. But to get back to your question, yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, the idea that, you know, vaccines will prevent transmission is obviously something that we've all realized in the last year or so is unfortunately not the case. And with the vaccine efficacy, you know, there was a recent study using these neutralizing antibodies that show that, you know, 30% of people in certain age groups that are double vaccinated don't generate detectable levels of these neutralizing antibodies. So if you're walking around with the assumption that you're safe because of your double vax status, unfortunately, based on your age or your comorbidities or health status, that may not be the case. You know, and these are likely the folks that are experiencing reinfection or breakthrough infection. So I would say this, mm-hmm. We don't know for certain that your true immune result is enough to protect you for, you know, the next 12 months. But I will say that your result is as good as you can hope for. And so we obviously encourage everyone to exercise caution, but know that you're generating a very, very effective immune response based on your either past exposure or your vaccines and boosters. But it is an uncertain time, and it is difficult when we do hear about positivity rates of, you know, 1 in 3 folks and things like that at the moment. So it's a tricky time.
It certainly is a tricky time. You can say that again. Wondering about the booster then, what is the current research on the efficacy of the booster?
Yeah, so the neutralizing antibody work that's been done to evaluate the benefits or the additional benefits, if you will, of a booster are fairly clear, and that is that the data shows that the waning antibody response that we do see over a 6 to 8 month period following vaccinations or infection, they are bolstered by the booster from a neutralizing antibody standpoint, which is great news, okay? So it does reinforce that production of these potent soldiers that will block the virus from entering the cell. But again, we're a little too early in the timeline of boosters to know exactly how long that's going to last for and what the longitudinal scheduling of these boosters could look like. Look, to be honest, there's also encouraging evidence to suggest that even when these antibody levels begin to wane, those memory immune cells that make these antibodies are very well equipped to do that on demand if we are exposed to the virus again. So, you know, we do hope to have a threshold to share with you all for these neutralizing antibodies soon so that we can at least have an objective target to shoot for with respect to our immune response. But the hope is that even if we fall below that threshold at some point in time, our immune system is able to kick back into gear and produce more of these neutralizing antibodies on demand should we be exposed to COVID in an annual seasonal fashion, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So the strains covered by this test are, there's some fancy letter and number combinations on my result, but I'm assuming it tests for your neutralizing antibodies for any strain of COVID.
That's a great question. So the test itself is designed to look at the ancestral or wild type binding domain of the virus, so the original form of the virus. And then what essentially is done at that point is each of the variants is evaluated based on their impact or effect compared to the wild type. So we do see a slight decrease in neutralization with the Delta variant. Not so much with some of the other earlier variants, but you can see a 10% decrease in efficacy against these variants. So again, when we have a threshold and we know exactly what we should be looking for, whether that be 80% inhibition or 50% inhibition, that 10% becomes more relevant, okay? Because we can actually see that maybe someone is going to fall below that if they are exposed to a variant. Right now, the inventors, again, are publishing a lot of data showing that there is a small decrease in efficacy, but nothing that would significantly change your status or move you from one quadrant down to the next, if you will.
What about Omicron?
Yeah, so a little early. We're obviously identifying Omicron from a sequencing standpoint. This test is a little unique in that in order for us to evaluate Omicron as a variant for TrueImmune, we have to actually purify the receptor binding domain of each of these new variants, you know, inclusive of their respective mutations, and convert that into a research grade or clinical grade reagent to actually introduce it to the test. So there's a bit of a lag in being able to look at these different variant RBDs on TrueImmune. So I would love to report back to you on that. But again, we're going to assume that it's going to be slightly less than the wild type, but again, nothing that would diminish your result to any great extent.
Great. Well, Dr. Joshua Gunn, I'm so glad you could join me all the way from Australia, sunny Australia, I'm sure. He is the Chief Scientific Officer at Ethos Labs. And if we want to go and order the test online, is it just ethos-labs.com and then you look for the TrueImmune test? Is that the best way to get it?
Yeah, there's a direct link on ethos-labs.com. There's also www.u-collectkit.com, which is kind of the central housing for all of our at-home or U-Collect kits. So folks can access it that way as well.
And I feel like I looked it up and you can order it. I mean, can you just order it on Amazon or anything like that? Other places?
So we have partners in the clinical collection world. So ArcPoint Labs, which is a collection center located in a lot of cities around the US, offer the test. You can purchase it through those two URLs I just mentioned, but that would be the only place you could buy it online, would be through our website or the U-Collect website.
Okay. And just 15 seconds left, but I want to make the point that, or the question, you know, at what point are we going to be able to travel? For example, if we want to travel internationally, we show our TrueImmune test results showing you have high immunity. Do you see that in the future?
Yeah, 100%. I've actually been quite surprised that it has taken a while for the neutralizing antibody technologies to be more of a focus. I think it's happening now. And I think as we talk about natural immunity versus vaccine-induced immunity versus boosters, we're all going to have to start speaking a common language, which is, you know, what's our dynamic current, you know, protection, and something like TrueImmune or other technologies like it are going to be the answer. So, yeah, I do see that in the future.
Okay, excellent. Josh, thank you so much for joining me on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Lynn. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
You too. And thanks to our supporters, Nexus IT, Peak Murray Real Estate, San Francisco Design, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. Stay tuned now.